The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell told lawmakers on Capitol Hill today that the country remains a long way away from reaching its goal in the fight against inflation. Last week, the central bank announced it would not raise interest rates for the first time in more than a year. But while testifying in front of the House Financial Services Committee, Chairman Powell said more rate hikes are likely.
How much commercial debt is coming due? How it's going to hit? What can you tell us about the numbers right now?
Big numbers. The Mortgage Bankers Association says over the next 2 years in the U.S. alone, $1.4 trillion of debt coming due. There's a lot of it that's office debt, and that will be harder to refinance because A, the cost of borrowing is up, and B, the value of those buildings are down. And so people are going to have to pay a lot of money or decide not worth it to refinance these places.
One of the interesting things to me is that incredibly asset-rich institutions with very wealthy investors are starting to simply walk away. Are they really going to just default and leave?
Well, they can't wait forever to get their money back. And it will take until 2040 at least for office values to recover. So if I have property now, I'm not going to wait for another 17 years to get my money back. I don't have that kind of time. So better now to cut my losses than keep pouring good money after bad.
We all know that fewer people are going into offices than used to be the case. So if you go to big office buildings in New York City, you're going to see people there maybe 2 or 3 days a week if you're lucky. At some point, people are going to say we need less space. And at some point, the value of these buildings is going to go down. There's no doubt about it. And so you're going to see some real estate debt is going to be for sale at discounts to what it is today. That's probably the biggest opportunity over the next 2 or 3 years is discounted real estate debt in large commercial office buildings in big cities.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stocks closed out the week on a negative note as fears over more rate hikes and a looming recession weighed on investors this week. Wall Street has been hoping for a Fed pivot with lower interest rates by the end of the year. It appears that that may not be happening anytime soon. The futures market now assigns a 73% probability of another quarter-point rate hike coming next month, with another rate hike coming later on this year in November. Secretary Yellen spooked markets Friday by saying more bank mergers lie directly ahead of us. And on the economic front, higher mortgage rates are hurting the housing market, with existing home prices posting their biggest year-over-year decline in more than 11 years. Home prices fell 3.1% nationally from a year ago. In other news, Jeff Bezos told employees eventually Amazon will go bankrupt, but his goal is to delay the inevitable for as long as possible. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. On today's show, I'll be doing an extended interview with Greg Weldon as we discuss the impact of Fed policy on U.S. debt markets, global inflation, the bubble in AI stocks, and the coming bull market in commodities. But before we do that, let's head down to Wall Street and find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
It was a short week in the financial markets due to Juneteenth, with trading that largely resembled consolidation from the month's gains and rotation out of gainers and into laggers. The key market events this week were Powell's semiannual congressional testimony, economic data updates in housing and preliminary manufacturing data, as well as more central bank rate hikes. The main story is a consolidation in growth stocks and a rotation into defensive areas that have lagged. Some have likened it to a broadening of the market's depth and see it as a good sign, a soft landing scenario is likely, while others continue to brace for continued growth concerns. Interestingly, I remember in 2000, the very same broadening of market breadth occurred before the eventual recession and bear market over a three-month period. Time will tell if it's different this time. Tuesday, 26 of 30 Dow components showed losses, showing a broad retreat in stock gains on the back of strong gains earlier in the month. Tesla did not see those losses as it announced yet another partnership with Rivian, with both stocks up 5% on the day. Wednesday was the start of a two-day House and Senate committee meetings for Fed Chair Jay Powell. You reiterated many of the topics discussed last week at the conference following the Fed's decision to skip a rate hike, stating that all Fed officials anticipate the need for additional tightening before year end. He said, reducing inflation is likely to require a period of below trend growth and some softening of labor market conditions. To further support Powell's comments this week, Fed Governor Michelle Bowman, a voter, said in a speech, additional policy rate increases will be necessary to bring inflation down. The July Fed funds futures were little changed from the day before, with a 79% probability Wednesday of a 25 basis point hike, according to the CME FedWatch tool, while the probability of a hike after July is below 21% for the following three meetings. The second day of the meeting before the Senate Banking Committee went largely the same. However, the committee members all showed concerns regarding capital requirements for banks. Combining those concerns with growth concerns saw the bank stocks fall, with the bank ETF KBE down 3.2% on the day. In other banking developments, stocks experienced significant downward pressure on Thursday. This was driven by a series of interest rate hikes by prominent financial institutions, namely the Bank of England, Norges Bank, Swiss National Bank, and the Central Bank of Turkey. These institutions implemented rate increases ranging from 25 to 50 basis points, with Turkey taking the lead by raising rates by a substantial 650 basis points, resulting in a new rate of around 15%. Such actions by these central banks have sparked apprehension about the state of global economic growth, with banks raising rates. On the economic front, total housing starts surged month over month by 21.7%, the highest since April 2022, while total building permits rose 5.2% month over month, mostly by an increase in single unit permits. These were some welcome signs. Existing home sales also increased 0.2% month to month, but were down 20% from a year ago. Leading economic indicators were down for the 14th consecutive month, falling 0.7% in May. Initial jobless claims held steady at 264,000. The biggest news on the week was the preliminary June manufacturing PMIs, that's Purchasing Managers Index data, for Japan, Germany, the UK, the Eurozone, and the US. All came in below 50, which denotes contraction, supporting the growth concerns we saw this week. To summarize this week's performance, the Dow Industrials closed down 1.67%, NASDAQ closed down 1.44%, the S&P 500 closed down 1.4%. In sector performance this week, healthcare was the only sector up, scoring a gain of 0.2% for this S&P's 500 Spider Fund. Staples were down 0.4% behind that. At the bottom this week, real estate was down 4%, energy was down 3.6%, tech down 3.2%, and utilities down 2.1%. In treasuries, the 10-year held fairly flat on the week at around 3.74% yield. Oil was down 3.85% to close at $69 a barrel, copper down 2.2%, and gold fell 2% down to $19.29. It was a short week and a short list of news stories to cover, but that wraps up the week with a consolidation in stocks on growth concerns. Powell reiterating the need for more policy firming, other central banks raising rates, an uptick in housing data, but a downtick in LEIs and preliminary manufacturing PMIs for June. Up next, we've got a special guest here, Greg Weldon.
The dollar is clearly losing its reserve status, but not for economic reasons. It should be pointed out that when Russia went into Crimea back in 2014, Obama went to SWIFT and wanted to have them removed, and they refused. They said, you're talking about destroying the financial system. And so what did they do? They replaced the head of SWIFT in 2019. So then Biden goes in, oh, remove. Oh, okay, fine. Who else you want us to do that to? Anybody? You know, and SWIFT just committed suicide. They're no longer the clearing establishment for the entire world. The problem we have here is that this is what brings down the dollar from the reserve currency.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals.
Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, everybody is talking about a new bull market in stocks. What makes this interesting, it'll be probably one of the first times, if it is a new bull market, that we've done it before a recession. Well, let's find out where we're heading, whether it's the markets or commodities. Joining me on the program is Greg Weldon. He's publisher of Weldon Online and the ETF Playbook. Greg, I want to get your take on the stock market. We've had a handful of stocks that have been driving the major indexes, whether you're looking at the S&P and the NASDAQ. And now Wall Street is saying this is a new bull market. What's your take here?
Well, I think, you know, Wall Street always wants to say that. First of all, Jim, this is why you have a show and I have a business, because we're not part of the financial media that has a vested interest to see stocks go up forever, right? And that's always the positive attitude. That's always the positive guess that they have on. Every guy's a stock market guy and every guy's bullish. So yes, of course, that's the narrative. But it, you know, it comes down to expectations around Fed policy. You know that, I know that. You have gone from Fed policy expectations, which are pricing in 3% Fed funds next year, 200 basis points worth of cuts, and cuts beginning this year, okay, a few months ago, back in March, to now where it's pretty much flat at 5.25 till the second half of next year when maybe they cut 50 or 75 basis points. So I would say, number one, the backdrop for that bullishness has been toned down, which I think is something the Fed really wanted and is why they've kept with this hawkish rhetoric, even though they're probably, they already know in my mind, they're not going to hike rates again, okay? Because inflation has fallen to 4. We said this in March. We said this last October. You know, the base effect in energy was very clear. It's hitting now. You could see a 3-handle inflation. What does that mean? Why is that important? It's important because with Fed funds at 5.25 at the top end, Fed funds has a positive real rate now of, 125. That is what you would call relative to R star and, you know, thousands of pages that they wrote in 2018 about this. That means that the Fed policy right now is somewhat restrictive. Now, they say want to get more restrictive. Well, inflation will fall again and they'll be more restrictive. So the Fed is kind of restrictive into an economy where the majority of people, 33%, think they will be worse off a year from now, where only 24% of people say they'll be better off a year from now. Against the stock market, where, yeah, the index, the S&P 500 has broken out through the first level of overhead support. It's held some of the technical levels it needed to hold. There is some evidence that you have kind of a last gasp bull market that could actually take you to new highs here, technically speaking. But this is about as narrow a market as I've ever seen that is talking about a new bull market and potentially reaching all-time highs. You have 30% of the S&P 500 stocks are trending bullishly. 20% are trending bearishly. That's 10% margin, all right? And the bulk of the bullish stocks, as we know, are in information technology. Our models that we use in our ETF playbook, which we publish and is a great product to help investors kind of keep ahead and keep pace with the debasement of the purchasing power of their money, which is really the biggest backdrop that's going on. But within the stock market, you know, keeping in the places that are have bullish backdrop in terms of the trends, in terms of the fundamentals, in terms of the technicals, that's the places to be. It's been infotech. It will remain infotech until this market probably gets a reality check on the economic side sometime in the fall. If you ask me, Jim, the only thing that's missing from kind of a 1987 analog is that people were way more wildly bullish in 1987. But you have a lot of the same things at play. You have a lot of the same kind of tracking here that suggests you get a wake-up call, you know, through end of August. And the fall is a whole nother story economically. Is potentially a whole nother story with inflation maybe coming back, and is a whole nother story in terms of the stock market, you know, having its reality check.
Well, let's talk about the futures market is saying almost like a 70% probability, another quarter point hike in July, and maybe one more later on this year, September, November, who knows when. What's your take? Will they raise another quarter of a point, or is this just talk?
Well, I think, I'm not sure, you know, Jim, and I think that really this comes down to one question in my mind. Does the Fed want the stock market to break? You know, you've had disinflation in a lot of things except stocks, and to a lesser extent, except for gold, right? So if the Fed doesn't want to be seen as ending a tightening campaign and potentially, you know, flipping the narrative from fighting inflation to protecting the economy, which would theoretically, at least for a short time, be bullish for stocks, I don't think they necessarily want to do it with stocks within reach of record highs. So I think that kind of works against the narrative that they want out there. So I don't know. I'll tell you one thing about Powell. He has done exactly what he was going to say, even when what we thought he was saying was wrong. All right. They definitely waited way too long to hike rates. All right. But at the same time, Powell had said before that, we're going to let inflation get high, well above average, and we're not going to move for a while. He did exactly what he said he was going to do. So in this case, he's done exactly what he was going to say he's going to do on the other side. And he wants pain. He wants less credit creation. And these things are happening. These are not good things economically going forward. They're not good things for the stock market going forward, but the stock market hasn't reacted to that. And I think that might be the missing piece of the puzzle, frankly, for the Fed. Is there some fear that, you know, service inflation, shelter? Let's consider this, Jim. You know, you spend how much money on gas? You fill your car up, you know, maybe twice a month if you're an average guy. I don't know how many times but, you know, it's a couple $100, right, to fill up your car over the course of a month. All right. So, you know, an 8% inflation rate on gasoline, okay, it's a few bucks. 8-9% inflation on shelter where you pay thousands of dollars a month is a much different story. It's much more embedded. It's much more sticky. We know from the housing market situation, once you come out of this downturn in mortgages and you've seen some signs of light there, you're going to have such a hot housing market because you have such a lack of supply. That still exists. And this has made it worse because home builders have stopped building homes. And when you hit this next inflation round, it's going to be vicious in housing. So there's reasons why the Fed could stick to that narrative. But when I look at where policy is now, where the economy is now, I don't think they need to go, but they might anyway. So I'm not sure. I really don't know.
And the other thing that strikes me too, Greg, and I mean, it's hard to believe that a little over a year and a half ago, we were at 0% interest rates. I'm looking at 6-month treasury bills at 5.4%. Point I'm making, we just crossed $32.1 trillion in debt. I think the deficit will be over $2 trillion this year. And you take a look at, as the government's debt, I think it's close to 1/3 of it's going to roll over in the next 18 months. We're going to go from what they were paying maybe 0.1% on a 3-month T-bill. They're going to be going to over 5%, which will equal almost $1 trillion in interest. That will be 20% of government's tax revenues. And if we're up at $36, $38 trillion by the time Biden exits the White House, if that happens, we're going to be up to close to $2 trillion. Where's this money going to come from?
Well, Jim, you've hit on one of the biggest points of contention, of order, of disorder out there, the debt and the deficit. You know, I mean, the debt ceiling argument, of course, one of the most ridiculous things ever, because you know they're going to raise the debt ceiling. Why? Because the government's bankrupt, Jim. They're insolvent. They can't operate without borrowing trillions of dollars or more money, not even for a single day. What is this? I mean, does that not scream at you how, you know, dysfunctional this is? Now, let's take the numbers. All right. And I'm really glad you brought this up because we just did a piece on this last week. The May debt ceiling, right? You're at 34.1 already. Just raised the debt ceiling by $3 trillion. That takes you to 37 plus by the end of this fiscal year, which means $40 trillion by the end of 2024. $40 trillion, Jim. I mean, that means the next time you have a recession, how much more money do you have to print? $12, $15 trillion to get the same bang for your buck that you did in 2008 or the same bang for your buck you got in 2020, right? It becomes parabolically higher amount of money you need to keep printing. That's number one. Number two, the deficit in May was $240 billion. That's quadruple the May a year ago rate, number one, okay? Number two, when you talk about seven of the last 11 months, three of the last four have been above $200 billion, all right? When you take $240 billion and you extrapolate it out, it's $2.9 trillion a year annualized. So you're running at $3 trillion a year already here, right? When you knock that down into a 5-day work week, a 10-hour per day work week, all right, the government has to borrow $1 billion, more than $1 billion every hour just to stay in business. You know, I mean, this is like taxpayers have an addicted child that's out of control and we're just keeping enabling them by giving them more money. And it's like, you know, the insanity of this is just, you know, it's beyond belief. And it's someday that becomes a problem. And I think you're in the zone now, where in the next phase, this could affect the effectiveness of Fed policy. You mentioned interest cost. All right. Interesting. I just did the numbers on this a week ago, right? So it's still fresh in my head. In 2022, the interest cost on the debt was $475 billion, almost half a trillion, right? $475 billion. And like you said, that's going to multiply even more because in 2023, we saw how much rates went up, all right? Still, $475 billion. Okay. The entire deficit in 2008 was $458 billion. All right. The current cost of paying interest on the deficit is now larger than any single year deficit before 2008 in the history of the U.S. That's how insane this has become, is when you look at it from those tangible visuals of kind of like how out of control this is. Here's one more stat that I'll throw at you. All right. In this context of this deficit that we just had in May, revenue fell 21% year over year, and yet they still spent 20% more in the month. It doesn't get much more polarized or insane than it is right now. And this can't continue. And at some point, I think in the next phase, this starts to impact the effectiveness of Fed policy.
Yeah, because let's say that Powell keeps rates up and he raises one or two more times for whatever reason, doesn't want the market going up or who knows what they're thinking. If that happens and we do go into a recession, Greg, typically when you go into recession, the Fed lowers interest rates, and they certainly at this level have room to do that. But also, Congress will pass some kind of fiscal spending program to kickstart the economy. And next year, Greg, is a presidential election year. And you know, no politician of either party wants to face the voters in a recession with rising unemployment. So how much more are they going to spend to kickstart the economy?
It's as if they, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. And the markets even have become immune to this. And there comes a day where you wake up and, you know, you mentioned the amount of, you know, percentage of revenue that it will take to cover just the interest burden, right? I mean, the UK is already at 12%. I mean, and that's just to cover the increase in the last 12 months. 12% of revenue just to cover the increase in the interest expense over the last 12 months. I mean, you know, bottom line is this leads to higher inflation. It leads to more money printing. It means the same thing that is the biggest single thing that is going on right now that people don't fully wrap their heads around, I don't think, which is the omnipresent debasement of the purchasing power of your money, wealth, and income. And it's happening with all paper currencies, Jim. I could read you some stats on Turkey right now that would absolutely blow you out of the water in terms of how much the purchasing power of the Turkish lira and for the people of Turkey, a country of 80 million people. I'll give you a quick one on this because it's important to note, because this is going on everywhere, man. It's not just the U.S. This is global. And, you know, it doesn't lead to a higher standard of living. And it becomes increasingly difficult to keep pace with the debasement of the purchasing power of your money because, you know, he could buy stocks, make new highs in Turkey. Stock market makes new highs in Argentina. Every year, but the standard of living is not higher because inflation and the devaluation of the currency is so rampant. Let me just tell you real quick, in Turkey, they raised the minimum monthly wage to 11,400 lira. They just doubled it in the last 12 months. So it used to be 700, you know, whatever it was, is lira per 5,600 lira per month. All right, 11,000 lira right now translates into $483 a month. That's the minimum wage. In 2008, that same 11,400 lira would have been $10,200. So imagine going from making 140 grand a year to making $5,000 a year. That's kind of what the average person in Turkey has gone from. And that's the purchasing power debasement of their currency. And this is happening everywhere.
You know, I just read a figure, Greg, globally debt, and this is everybody, 400 trillion. In the U.S., we just crossed 101 trillion of government, corporate, and individual debt. It is unsustainable. And you and I know there's only three things you can do with debt. Number one, you can default. Don't see that happening. Two, you can pay it back. Don't see that happening. Or number three, you inflate it away. And to me, that's their only way out.
That's always been the way. I mean, you know, and I wrote in my book in 2006, you know, I called it monetary Armageddon. I mean, you come to a day when, you know, in all the old movies, when they have to launch the nukes, right? You have to have the guy from the army and the president both in the bunker, and they both got to turn the key simultaneously. Well, in this version, it would be the Fed chairman and the treasury chief in the bunker turning the monetary keys at the same time and printing enough money to buy back every dollar of debt ever sold. All right. But then a loaf of bread costs $100. Why? Because the dollar is worthless. All right. And this is where we're going. You know, and you inflate your way out that way by printing more money. And that's what they've been doing for 40 years. And not going to change now. What's changed is the trajectory and the trend, long-term secular multi-decade trends in interest rates and inflation. And inflation is here to stay, Jim. And we got to talk about El Nino because that's a big thing for food inflation, which is, you know, still very sticky around 6% in the U.S. and higher most of the places around the world.
I want to get to commodities in just a moment, Greg, but one of the things that struck me, Friday I went to a company, Total Wine Company, and where I shop and get my wines, a couple bottles had these weird contraptions on top of the bottle. And I asked the guy, I said, how come you're doing it on this particular wine and that particular wine? He said, those are the most popular brands and they steal them. And I said, well, you can't stop them from stealing in California. He said, I know. That's why we put these on, because when they try to take them off, they break the bottle. I mean, seriously, you cannot stop. In California, we passed a law, you can shoplift $950.
Same in New York City too, yeah.
Yeah, and then I go to the grocery store and they got these little hand baskets if you're just going to buy a few goods. I didn't see them anywhere. And I asked one of the carryouts, I said, where are you keeping the baskets now? He said, we don't have any. I said, what do you mean you don't have any? He said, the seniors steal them.
That's the shoplifters, you know, limit is the baskets. They had, you know, they had their own little basket that you can take this much stuff. So that's what people did, right? I mean, bottom line, this is the first signs of anarchy coming into play, Jim. This is the first signs of social unrest among the have and have nots. The people that don't have, they're getting crushed by inflation, man. Think of the average family of four that makes 60 grand a year, can barely live on that much money right now. So of course, these are the things that are happening because this is the beginning of the next big secular phase of social unrest. And I'm telling you, the next time you have a situation with unemployment and you have stagflation, where unemployment is lower, but inflation and cost of food especially is higher, think of this dynamic you're talking about multiplied by 100, because that's what's coming, unfortunately. I mean, it's an unfortunate outcome of the realities of the macroeconomic situation, but that's what we deal in. And we try and find opportunities to help you keep pace, but that's becoming increasingly more difficult.
The inflation, you know, you were talking about housing and rent. We have housing shortages. You know, a two-bedroom apartment here is $3,000. And one of my guests on real estate said, you know, people in New York would jump to pay $3,000 for a studio apartment. And then I came across another situation where one client's kids cannot afford to stay in an apartment. So they're taking their van and they're going to become homeless and move on to the beach. And here in San Diego, it's like that in San Francisco and Los Angeles. If you're homeless, you get free medical, you get a cell phone, you get free food. I mean, so.
And who pays for that, Jim? I mean, everyone else is working.
Yeah.
And that creates tension, that creates bitterness, that creates social unrest, that creates anarchy, ultimately. Let me throw a real curveball at you, Jim, because it's something I started talking about after I saw a recent article that I'll share with you at the very end of this, all right? I mean, if you think about it, if you really just grind out all of Americanism and capitalism and democracy and all the things that, you know, are political and kind of socioeconomic, you know, structures in, that we have in our society, who the heck thinks they really own land on this planet? I mean, frankly, the whole concept is kind of almost, it just seems an anathema to what you would call true freedom. I mean, where nobody owns any land, it's kind of open territory, like back in the 1800s or something. I don't know. But I say this because one of the things I've always thought about is, you know, at some point you get enough of these people where you have roaming bands of people taking over properties, you know, because they need a place to live and stuff like this. When that level becomes, you know, a bigger minority to the point where it's approaching potentially being a majority, who knows, that becomes a real deal thing that people might have to deal with in the future. I bring this up because I saw a recent article about how many properties Bill Gates owns, how big they are, how many of them they are, how much they're worth, right? And one of them happens to be here near me in, you know, West Palm Beach, Florida, in Wellington. It's big horse farms out there, big ranches, man, big pieces of property. And he owns some kind of, you know, multi-acre things, like some like 50-something acres out there, whatever. But there's a group now that is going to be like occupy Bill Gates's acreage in Wellington, where all these people want to go out there and take the place over and make it a basically a refugee camp. So these are things that are happening that will continue to happen more frequently. This whole Occupy thing, you know, people say, oh, they had Occupy Wall Street and it failed and nothing ever came of it. No, it's alive and well, and it's only going to grow. And these are the things you're going to be dealing with in the future. It's unfortunate, but it's a reality.
You know, it's interesting, Greg, because we're talking about coming inflation. And if you read about what happened in Germany, the Weimar Republic, you're seeing this come out socially, because I was watching a news program, a financial program, and they had a gentleman who has rental properties in Los Angeles, and a couple of them are vacant, and the squatters just moved in and he can't move them out. And when he tried to move them out, they burned his house down.
Well, you know, I just had something in my mind. I actually totally forgot what I was going to say here, but I mean, gosh, Jim, I mean, it's starting, it's happening. We see it right in front of us and it's only going to get worse. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, even what's happening with the environment and the climate, I mean, think about the places that people won't be able to live in the future and how much less land there might be. And stuff like this, you can really get, you know, very in depth with this. But, it, you know, at the same time, you know, we're near-term focused, trying to find the opportunities to help you keep pace with the inflation that we've seen already and the inflation that's coming next, because it's going to be more significant, especially when we start talking about food, Jim. When you start talking about, you know, place to live, that's one thing. When you start talking about eating, when you start talking about having enough water, because of El Nino, there's already places in Central South America that are rationing water, for crying out loud.
And I want to move next to commodities because, Greg, if we take a look at the inflation that we had, the highest in almost 40 years, I want to get your take on gold. And one of the things, and especially silver, what strikes me about silver, I think silver is roughly about $23. And it went under 23 briefly on the day you and I are speaking. But, you know, Greg, you go to Kitco and you want to buy a silver eagle, you're going to pay a 90% premium over spot. Now, I'd like to get your take on that, because why is silver trading at 23 on the COMEX and I'm paying, or anybody would pay, 90% premiums? Is it a situation where you have the government that says, we're only going to produce X amount of eagles, that's it? Where you and I, Greg, if we were running the business and we were making eagles, if we had more demand, we would make more eagles. That's not the way the government works. So explain that dichotomy between the price of silver on the COMEX. And by the way, I've never seen inventories fall like they are in silver on the COMEX, and then the price you would pay at Kitco. Explain that one.
Decades old question, Jim, and really no smart answer I can give you other than to say, we know this is among the most manipulated markets in the world. We know that, you know, greed is good. Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan are critical in manipulating things like nickel, like silver, like all of a sudden our inventory as well. We just looked and we have a bag of rocks instead of a bunch of nickel here, you know? I mean, Jim, seriously, I don't know about the numismatic side, the coin side. To me, just a bar, man. Just, you know, the local dealers here in Florida, I know that, you know, of course, there's always a premium because people have businesses and so on and so forth. But, you know, it's not out of whack the way you're telling me it is with a place like Kitco, who is certainly has always had a good reputation up until now. So I don't know. In terms of the eagles and stuff like that, of course, it's a supply-demand fundamental there against the supply-demand fundamental that is artificially, you know, created in the futures market. I will tell you this, there will come a day when the dollar will get whacked and these metals are going to be much higher. You know, it's been disappointing to a lot of people and it's been a lot of fits and starts. I mean, you've been above 2,000, you just can't stay up there. The Fed doesn't want to see gold above $2,000 right here when they're going to stop tightening. They don't want to see the stock market near record highs. That's part of the problem for them right now, all right? But it will come a day when this is just going to be like holding a beach ball under the water, and when you let go, it explodes up to the surface. That's the precious metals right now. And the degree to which you say they're disappointing, I would counter by saying you just had one of the strongest periods of the dollar in the last 40 years. And guess what? The metals held up pretty dang well. So I would say there's some positives in there. I would say it's going to require a lot of patience. I'm going to say there's a lot of powers that be that don't want to see that happen, but inevitably they can't stop it. Okay. So this is still a secular long-term bullish story that does have risk in the near term. You know, if you have some kind of event that, you know, dollar debt is the big issue and that could drive the dollar higher and that could be a real problem for gold and silver. But I still think even if gold and silver were to go down, it goes down less than other things go down, because in that same scenario, stocks would be getting whacked. So I still think from a long-term perspective, gold is cheap relative to stocks. And I still think longer term, gold is the beach ball being held below the surface of the water.
The surprising thing, even though some money has flown out of the gold ETFs, central bank buying of gold has never been this strong.
Yeah, the open interest in gold, you know, on the futures market is virtually, you know, at a multi-year low. I mean, so the speculators are not involved, and the governments are the ones that are buying it. I mean, you know, in the past, when governments are selling, it's when you want to buy it. But right now, that's flipped. It really has. So I think that's a telltale sign that governments understand the amount of money printing they have to do in the future. Governments are not stupid. It may not be the smartest people all the time, because you can't make as much money in a government as the private sector unless you're crooked. Well, we can talk about that all day long, but it's not really worth our while to do that. To focus on what matters is that, you know, at the end of the day, they know how much money they have to print. They know what's coming next, and they want to have some kind of backing to protect themselves, because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's we the people and the governments that represent us that are exposed here.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you were a central bank and let's say you're doing trade with the U.S., you're getting dollars and you know what the Fed's doing, what the budget deficits are. Do you really want to hold those dollars or do you want to hold gold?
Well, I think that that's very evident in the case of China and Russia and what's going on with currencies. You know, I've been talking about this for several years, really dating back to 2018 when China opened the Shanghai crude oil futures using the Dubai OPEC benchmark price as their benchmark and did that in renminbi and got Russia to benchmark all of their Urals crude prices to the Shanghai price. All right. This is all about petrodollar. It's all about the dollar as the, you know, means of commodity trade in the world. And let's talk about that from the perspective of China and their trade surplus, Jim. All right. They're running a trade surplus now of over $100 billion a month for the last 10 months in a row. $100 billion a month. Their inflation is less than 1%. I mean, come on. And then you start talking about the alliance with Russia. You start talking about the alliance between Saudi Arabia and Iran, something we have never seen before until Xi visited, you know, both places and has them talking. This is the new axis of power on the other side of the globe, Jim. OPEC, Russia, China involved, want to bring down the dollar. You know, you could say mutually assured destruction, but at the same time, you know China, you know Xi. He's a Maoist. His dad was number two guy in the Mao regime. Now, there's a lot of history to Xi that people don't fully understand. He is a Mao Zedong, basically a manifest destiny guy. All right. He's had skirmishes with Vietnam. They've had skirmishes with Malaysia. Philippines almost declared war on them recently. You know, you have the whole situation with Taiwan. It's a powder keg, man. And so from their perspective, they're the ones that are buying the most gold and most de-dollarizing. And I think that that's something we're going to see much more in the future. And that is when gold really starts to percolate. When you get this de-dollarization theme becoming more intent. You could say, well, that'll never happen because you can't buy enough Chinese bonds. Who cares about bonds, man? This isn't about bonds. It's about survival and it's about resources. And China has taken steps to make sure that they have enough resources for the future. You know, even going so far as the second the U.S. left Afghanistan, what were they doing? They were in there negotiating to build a superhighway through Pakistan and Afghanistan through to Iran and all the way straight down into Africa that would transport all different kinds of resources back to China. China has gone about this in a much smarter way than the U.S. does, borrowing money to do handouts. It's absurd, the dichotomy of how well Xi has played his hand versus how poorly the U.S. has played our hand. And, you know, it's sad to say, I mean, you know, I'm certainly not supportive of those policies, you know, that take place from a political perspective in terms of keeping people down. But the reality of the economic and the global macro scene is that they're in a stronger position right now. They hold the more powerful weapons than we do now. And that's a flip-flop.
Well, you take a look at anything that's in the green agenda. There was a hearing on Congress a couple of weeks ago, and one of the congressmen was asking this expert on this green transition. And the guy said, we don't have the metals to do that. We don't have enough copper, nickel, cobalt, lithium. You just go on. And that's what China is dominating in. They dominate solar. They're dominating wind, and they dominate the control of the minerals that you need to make this transition. And Greg, we could talk about magnets. You know, if we want to go to war, the Pentagon has to buy its magnets and its the chips it's going to need for its weapons from China. How's that going to work?
It goes even deeper than that, Jim, and you're right on. And I've been talking about that for a long time, and that's why we're so bullish on nickel. And that's why I've always said this whole green theme is not about saving the planet. You and I know that. It's about needing an engine of economic growth that we don't have anymore. It used to be the tigers and the emerging markets. Then it was China, you know, that for a while was the consumer and technology and advanced, you know, efficiency and production. It's none of that anymore. Now it's all about this kind of thing because we need to create something to support the growth of the debt. With no growth in the economy, we're going to just be buried by this debt and we're going to suffocate, right? So, of course, this is all about, you know, quote unquote, you know, climate change, which is a real thing, but it has something to do with tens of thousands of years of science and cycles and the planetary movements here and the solar system movements. And it's so much bigger than people realize. NASA's already retermed it solar warming. I say that all the time because it is. Ice shelves on Pluto are melting. This is much bigger than planet Earth and human beings driving SUVs. But they create this narrative because they need an engine of economic growth. It doesn't matter that it's not feasible. It doesn't matter that it's completely a fantasy to ever achieve the goals they seek to achieve because they don't have the resources. But it goes even to outer space, Jim, because metals like dysprosium, okay, which is a metal that actually changes dimension in certain ways and is extremely, you know, resistant to heat. These are like space age metals that will go into the construction of spaceships, literally, in the future, that China has control of 88% of these rare earth metals and minerals and nanometals and all these different things that, you know, the bulk of our trade deficit with China, by the way, is in exactly those things too. Over 50% of our trade deficit with China is rare earth elements. So it goes really deep. And that is a huge point. And again, it just tells you how much better China has played all this than the U.S. I mean, it just pains me. I cringe when I have to say that, but it's true. We deal in the realities of what's going on, not the fantasies you hear on television.
So as you look at commodities, I don't care if it's copper, nickel, gold, silver, oil, what's your take? I mean, we've seen oil prices come down. We've seen natural gas prices come down. Copper looks like it's ready to take off, in my opinion. What's your take on commodities? What would you be doing if you wanted to get into commodities? Would you stand on the side? Would you start taking positions? Would you nibble? What would you be doing?
Well, I think people absolutely have to be involved, Jim. And that's one of the reasons, not to bring it up too much, if you're too salesman, and you know me, I don't like to promote myself, but the ETF playbook deals with this exact issue. Because a lot of, you know, stock guys don't want to or can't afford to, or for whatever reason, get into the futures markets, which I'm a huge proponent of. I also will tell you, most people in the futures markets are wildly undercapitalized and doomed to failure. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? But that's why we're trying to help people with the ETF playbook. And I'd love to send our latest edition, which is coming out later today, free to anyone in your audience. Just has to email us, sales@weldononline.com, and we'd be happy to send it to you. But it deals with all these things, all the commodities you're going to need to be involved with. Most of them have ETFs. There were some liquidity issues. You know, ETFs are not as great as they could be, but it will help you keep pace with the inflation that's coming. And in terms of those commodities, you hit one on the head squarely. When you talk about copper, right? When you talk about zinc, tin, the inventories, the Western warehouse inventories of these metals are historic lows, if not, you know, 15-year lows, in some cases, 30 and 40-year lows of inventories of these metals, Jim, all right? And you're just now starting to see the backwardation return to the markets, right? Where the nearby is at a higher price because you don't have enough metal to meet demand, all right? And to me, something like copper with historically low levels of inventories, all right? And you still have the latest numbers on trade, big import number on copper and some of these other resources, third largest month ever for crude oil out of China. So there's, you know, when prices go low, where do you see the support? And when you see the support and you link it to trade numbers, you will notice that support came from China. Again, playing it smarter, all right? Buying these commodities like copper. And you have a situation there where there's just not enough copper around. And copper got whacked because it's going to be a recession. It could be recession-proof because the supply-demand fundamentals are so out of whack that that suggests it could not really, you know, come down during recession just because there's no metal around. The second area I look at, and there's a CPOX is the copper mining ETF. There's a copper ETF. There's ETFs for a lot of these things. DBB is the base metal ETF. So there's ways to play this. And I think people need to have these in their portfolios. And we give model portfolios of these kinds of things in our ETF playbook. All right. The second place I would say is food, commodities, Jim, all day long. El Nino is here. We talked about it in March when NOAA had it at a 60% probability. Last month, NOAA said it is now happening. It's an 18 to 24 month at minimum process. We're in month two, Jim. Already, we have birds dying in Mexico by the hundreds because of the heat. We have a record dengue fever outbreak in Peru because it's twice the previous record because of all the rain and all the mosquitoes. The Panama Canal has limited the draft of ships. In other words, the maximum depth at which ships can pass through the canal because of the lack of water. What does this mean? Less goods on each ship. You have to take down the weight, right, to be able to go through the Panama Canal. You want to talk about supply chain issues coming up again? Bam. You want to talk about commodity price inflation coming up again? Bam. India monsoon, all right? The most recent shortfall across the country, middle of June, when it should be cranking out rain, shortfall of 33% at the low end to 95% shortage of rain relative to the norm in many places in the country. Sugar, cotton, rice, soybeans, and wheat, all involved here. And these are DBA is the agricultural commodity ETF that we've been recommending for quite some time on this. Coffee would be another one. Sugar is already, you know, making multi-year highs, big breakout. India just limited the exports of sugar because of El Nino. You have a water emergency in Uruguay. They're rationing water. These are the kind of things that are happening around the world right now in the last 2 weeks because of El Nino, and it's only going to get worse. NOAA has said that because of the climate change we already have, this El Nino event may be the worst in history. So that's what's coming, man. And you need to be prepared and taking some of these, it's taking being involved in some of these ETFs, being involved in some of these commodities, that's going to be the way to do it.
You know, it's amazing because when you take a look at this, with the pandemic, we were exposed to supply chain disruptions. And of course, the way the state of California is run, we could do a whole show on that. But people, for the first time in their life, when you wanted something, it wasn't there. You know, we all remember people hoarding toilet paper, but they think, well, that's over. That's behind us. And what I think you and I are telling them, no, just get used to it. It's coming.
Yeah. You know, the radiation at the 1,000 to 1,500 meter level below the surface of the Pacific Ocean is 40% above normal right now. It's like one of the highest on records. You know, this is affecting everywhere. Indonesia is already talking about the water and food. They're already trying to stock food. I mean, this is a for real thing that is happening that's going to get worse. And this is going to wreak havoc on the U.S. and this, that, and the other thing. And not only that, Jim, you're talking about a crop report a few months, 2 months ago, that was about as bearish on the prices, as bullish for the crop as it possibly could have been, you know? So you're starting from a point where you've already priced in the best possible scenario for crops. Any margin of error here is so thin that any kind of disruption will send some of these prices skyrocketing. And they all have ETFs. They all have futures market. You get involved. You know, we manage money for people in the commodities markets. If you don't have enough money to do this yourself, and I mean, again, most people are wildly undercapitalized. These markets are tough. They're volatile. The contract sizes are huge now. The amount of money you need to run the right kind of risk controls is pretty sizable. It really is. So most people just don't have the wherewithal to do it. And that's why we kind of started the ETF playbook again, not to hype on it, but I think it's a product that really helps a lot of people. And that's part of why we're doing it. You know, certainly we want to expand our business. But right now, it's more of a mission statement. I've been doing this for so long. It's almost like there's a bigger picture here for me to help people weather what's coming next, because a lot of it's going to be linked to the weather and a lot of it's going to be really vicious in terms of how you keep pace. Well, again, I keep saying it, but it's so important with the debasement of the purchasing power of your money.
You know, it's interesting because one of the top things that have hit both parties in Washington is modern monetary theory, which is basically you can issue as much debt as you want as long as it's your own currency, print as much money as you want as long as it's your own currency. But Greg, we're seeing the side effects, whether it's people stealing food, stealing wine, stealing things, the civil disrupt, taking over vacant properties. I mean, you're seeing the civil unrest that comes with inflation. And if you go back and read about the great, you know, Weimar Republic or some of these inflations in Argentina, you're talking about Turkey, you're talking about, you know, what's going on in Germany, we've seen it in Russia. These are the social effects of inflation that are breaking out.
Yeah. And Venezuela is another good example, too. I think there's a good corollary to be made between what's happening here and what happened in Venezuela as well. And what it is, Jim, is we said this before. I mean, you know, the stock market in Turkey and the stock market in Argentina makes a new all-time high every year. But that doesn't mean that people have a better life, right? And that's where I think people get lost in thinking, well, I own stocks, so I'll weather the storm. It's not gonna work like that this time around. And that is a function of the MMT mentality. Because if you really look at it, Jim, you can make it sound almost this simple. We take our cue from the government. The government is acting in a beyond irresponsible way. So why shouldn't everyone else?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, well, anyway, Greg, as we close one more time, tell people about the ETF playbook and Weldon Publishing.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Jim. And you guys always do such a good job. I'm always happy to contribute here. But at the same time, yeah, we do run a business. We manage money as a CTA. We will produce the Weldon Live, which is an everyday that talks about all this stuff, talks about all these markets, stocks, commodities, currencies, bonds, everything. You know, we got clients from the largest and most successful hedge funds in the world, all the way down to, you know, retired individuals trying to maintain their own portfolios. The ETF playbook is our newest product. It's actually a redo because we used to have this one a while back. That is, you know, for the stock guy who can't really trade futures, who now wants to, you know, try and keep pace with this debasement of their money and the value and the purchasing power, and it's going to become increasingly harder. And you have to try some things that are new instead of just this passive investing. Buy and hold and indexing is done, man. It's not going to keep pace. So you have to do things like be involved in these ETFs that we're talking about and to be more focused maybe in your equity picks. If you're just an equity guy, we offer quant work, technical work, macro work in there, and we give specific portfolios across three different portfolios for different types of investors within the playbook. Happy to send a free issue that we just about to publish later today of the ETF playbook to anyone listening, sales@Weldon Online. You can also reach us there for the Weldon Live free trial. And you can reach us there if you have any interest in our CTA. It is accredited investors only, $1 million minimum, not because we want $1 million, because that's how much we need to make our risk controls work. I'm not a very risky guy. I want 0.4% of risk and any one trade. And these days, you know, that could be a day's worth of gold. That's why it's $1 million. So we can manage the risk and, you know, keep our risk of ruin ratio, you know, as close to zero as possible. So all those things and any information can be found at Weldon Online, one word, weldononline.com, or you can email us sales@weldononline.com.
All right, Greg. Well, listen, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best and come back again.
My pleasure, Jim. Like I said, you guys go. Great job. I'm always happy to contribute.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.